Our connection this hour was made in June when the CEO of Wells Fargo wrote a company memo. He was responding to calls for more diversity in hiring. The killing of George Floyd in May had sparked protests about injustice on a number of levels, including who gets called back, who gets interviewed, who gets into college, who gets hired. CEO of Wells Fargo, Charlie Scharf, wrote in that memo that Wells Fargo doesn't hire many black people because, quote, there's a very limited pool of black talent to recruit from, end quote. News of that memo broke a couple of days ago, and Scharf has already apologized, citing his own bias. He wrote yesterday, quote, there are many talented, diverse individuals working at Wells Fargo and throughout the financial services industry, and I never meant to imply otherwise. It's clear to me that, across the industry, we have not done enough to improve diversity, especially at senior leadership levels. And there's no question Wells Fargo has to make meaningful progress to increase diverse representation, end quote. But Scharf's original comments reflected the kinds of comments we often hear in the corporate world, sure, but also in school districts where superintendents routinely tell us that they don't see any black candidates for teaching jobs. So how does this cycle change? Our guests this hour are here to offer their insight and expertise, and I will welcome them now. Mohammed Ahmed is the CEO and Chief Diversity Officer of EDI, Engaging Diversity and Inclusion, which is an executive search and diversity consulting firm in Rochester. Mohammed, welcome. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
Hello to Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Simeon, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Evan.
Adrian Hale, Strategic Initiatives Manager at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. Adrian, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, Simeon Bannister, let's start with you. When you first heard the comments from the Wells Fargo CEO from that memo, essentially saying we don't hire black people because they don't really apply, or we don't really have a big pool of talent to recruit from, what's the first thing that goes through your mind?
Well, it's an aim. And, you know, the way that I typically look at this is that in many ways jobs are the commodification of social capital. Someone begged the question, and perhaps it was the Congress member down in New York City, who questioned whether Mr. Scharf had the aptitude at identifying and recruiting black talent. And I think that that's a fair argument, and one that we certainly need to take into consideration in a number of different sectors, including here in our community.
Adrian Hale, what went through your mind when you first heard the comments?
So, I mean, obviously that's something that we hear often in the world of work, that folks just can't find black talent, and they don't think that, you know, I guess a lot of black people have interest in some of these fields where you see a disproportionately less amount of black employees, in particular finance. And I think there are definitely, we can see a heck of a lot more. But there are so many different factors and variables that have led to this disparity that goes far beyond hiring practices and whatnot. And so it's going to take a holistic, you know, effort to really try to ensure that we see parity between different, you know, races, genders, and various different aspects and components of diversity to really get there.
Mohammed, what did you think?
I echo the sentiments of my two panelists. It's a quintessential example of what, you know, we see in corporate America, particularly not just corporate, but in any field where folks do what we call performative diversity. On one end, they are echoing the sentiments on racial equity and anti-racism statements across the sectors and industry. And on the other end, they're concurrently sending internal memos to say that it's not feasible to do those things. So when I'm not surprised at all, it's something that we're quite familiar with and across industry.
Okay. But Mohammed, take me through the process then that you may engage with a firm that hires you saying, we don't want to just do performative, you know, so we don't want to be like sort of performatively woke. We actually want to do real work here. But, you know, if a CEO, Wells Fargo or otherwise, hires you and says, look, I'm struggling, and I admit I've got some weak spots here that I've got to correct here, help me. Where do we start?
It's a whole nother process. So we do a holistic pulse check. So we do a quick assessment of what's going on, what they're currently doing that is already working, to make sure that we don't you know, have some blind spots as we come in. We would like to understand how their processes work. And then we move into really looking to see who is already there that can move into these roles that they are aspiring to hire for. And then we make the analysis and assessment as to how we go about filling those positions. Because oftentimes what happens is that there is talent within that is overlooked. And we don't want to become part of the problem of just bringing in people and undermining and invalidating those who are already doing the work within the organization. They already have the tacit knowledge and understanding of the culture and how to disrupt it and how to make substantive change. So that's one of the things that we consider. But there's a whole lot of ways in which we review things from anywhere from the application cycle, the life cycle of that application process, how the job descriptions are framed and created, all the way to the appointment of the candidate. So we will train the committees. If there is any in place, if there is none, we'll figure out a way to make sure that there is bias mitigation throughout the application process so that that doesn't permeate in hiring the folks that they want to attract. I can go on and on, but that's the few. Those are the few things that we do.
Okay. Adrian Hale, I'm sure there are listeners who will send emails, and we'll take the emails this hour, connections at WXXI.org, or you can call 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm sure, Adrian, there are listeners who will express a sentiment that we hear occasionally, which sounds something like this. Well, why do we have to hire a white candidate or a black candidate or a man or a woman? Why can't we just hire the best candidate? What do you say to that, Adrian?
So some of the work that we're trying to do right now is help folks understand implicit and unconscious bias, that there's already a thought process that we all have and been indoctrinated in America and in most of the Western world where we're not even aware of it, but we already have a preconceived notion about what a supervisor is, about what certain C-level suite executives are, who they are, what they should look like, what they should bring to the table. And those are like the intangible forces that really work against more diverse applicants who apply to some of these high-level jobs and whatnot. Not that they're not capable, but they've been denied the opportunity to achieve and attain those levels of employment. And so what I call that is economic preclusion and employment preclusion, where people who are highly qualified, going back to my colleague's point who spoke right before me, who are already qualified, already acclimated into a certain work environment and climate, but just aren't given that extra opportunity or that the possibility of being promoted because of these underlying forces, thought processes, practices, and most importantly, these assumptions that mask themselves as common sense, are precluded from the ability to do so. And so right now we're trying to do work in our Colors of Success series that tries to get at that and just make more Americans aware and how insidious this can be and how undermining it could be to people realizing their possibilities in the workplace.
Well, before I turn to Simeon on that note, let me just ask you then, you're the Strategic Initiatives Manager at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. You've been with the Chamber for quite a while now. And I am curious to know, Adrian, if you, in your mind, how many, you know, what percentage of local companies, what percentage of the corporate world is what Mohammed described as sort of performatively anti-racist versus those who are truly intentional about trying to fix this issue?
So I'll just say really quick. So this is our last time talking. I'm the senior manager talent strategy, workforce development. Yeah.
Did I demote you on the show like this? Oh, my gosh. I'm part of the problem.
If I had the title before, it's good enough, right? But it's a pretty significant issue that we see. And there's a wonderful woman in town named Sarah Taylor, who I love. She's a mentor in the workforce development space. And she always says that, to Simeon's point earlier, right, it's the, you know, a commodification of social capital. So a lot of times sometimes in these all white homogenous spaces, you don't even have access to the network where people do have the aptitude to and the competency to recruit and to connect these organizations with these opportunities to people who are highly qualified. So that's the first piece. The second piece, too, is I think large in part, we have allowed organizations to get away with more cosmetic gestures, whether that can be a training or a seminar or bringing in a guest speaker, but there is no follow-up. And how is this work and information going to affect resource flows? How is it going to affect organizational thought and practice? Going back to my point about unconscious bias, or even our hiring practices, or how we write our job descriptions. And I mean, there's a lot of work right now. We can talk about it, you know, during the program, but there's a lot of work right now to even get away from the whole resume piece to really test people. Because I want to go back to what we started off talking about, the statement made by the Wells Fargo CEO. There are so many young men and women who are entrepreneurs out here who possess all of the abilities and capabilities of a C-suite level executive in corporate America, but just literally have either been excluded based on some kind of, you know, arbitrary requirement, or because of who they are, from actually having the opportunity to achieve and become that. And so some of the most, you know, those at the forefront and the vanguard in workforce development are leveraging technology and leveraging psychology and various ways to really assess folks' aptitudes to make sure you have the right fit for a certain position. But largely right now, it's very symbolic. It's very cosmetic in what we do to say that we're trying to work on diversity and inclusion. And it has to become a lot more concrete and substantive and actually produce some kind of change in the way the organization functions and administers opportunity.
Right. So when you see these kinds of diversity seminars, trainings, et cetera, you're right. I mean, they're happening everywhere. And I'm sure you've been in a number of these environments. How often are these companies calling back later to say, okay, we did the 1 day training. Now let's dig deeper. Now let's make the hire. Now let's connect to the town. How often are those follow-ups actually happening?
I'll say since George Floyd's murder, there has been a lot more organizations who are saying that they want to set objectives and they want to engage in inclusive practices, equitable policies since George Floyd. But the reality is when we start to actually implement, and I'll go back to a little bit of the training, I always tell, you know, the leadership of an organization that you have to keep the focus on what you want the organization to become. You can't focus on what the current composition will either like or don't like, because that will distract you and get you off course of where you're trying to become. So allow people to either select themselves into the organization that you want to create or deselect themselves based on what they don't want. But oftentimes just managing change. And I think because there seems to be a higher appetite to really engage in more concrete work, especially in the tech sector, there's efforts right now to leverage the diversity in our community to try to attract more remote, more satellite offices and diversify the operations that are in those offices beyond just sales, but to do a little bit more. How do we actually get them to stay on course? Because I think managing change is going to, you know, in many ways disrupt and upset a status quo that many people have enjoyed for some time, but it's definitely going to change.
Yeah. And Adrian, by the way, your career has been rather meteoric in its rise, and I know it has come with some title changes, but you also know I have nothing but respect for you, and I own getting an outdated title. Tell me again the updated title, and I will not make this mistake because that is on me. What's the title, sir?
Oh, no worries. It's just Senior Manager for Talent Strategy, Workforce Development, and Education Initiatives. Evan is okay.
Well, I got to own that. That's all right. Simeon Bannister, so the issue that I think Adrian and Muhammad bring up that I see from time to time is I see firms and they'll hire Robin DiAngelo to come in and she'll do a couple of hours and they'll go, well, good, aren't we good people? You know, we solve that one. How do we get beyond just that? I mean, and is there a risk to these, you know, these trainings and these seminars and workshops, which I'm sure matter, but is there a risk to thinking that that is sort of checking the box?
Yes, I appreciate the question. Let's stitch together the comments that we've previously heard, particularly around kind of performative diversity and then some of the bias pieces. So the fundamental question we have to ask, I think, is what's the motivation, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, why are organizations making this choice? I would argue that in my experience, I see kind of two key drivers. One is headline risk, right? They don't want to be, you know, behind, particularly if they're in competitive industries. They don't want to be seen, organizations don't want to be seen as not having embraced principles around diversity, because that might undermine their marketing advantage, right? So we see that. And we see that in a lot of the statements, frankly, that have come out supporting Black Lives Matter, right? We see that in some of that kind of language. The other piece might be morality, right? There might be some folks that legitimately think, right, in their hearts, this is the right thing to do, to really embrace diversity, because people deserve a chance. They want to deal with their issues of bias and so on and so forth. But I would argue that a third way might be even more important, and one that I find is often overlooked, and that's really focusing on rethinking value, right? And so a lot of organizations, and there's a whole bevy of research that demonstrates that diverse organizations typically perform better, particularly over the long term. And so let me give you an example of that, right? When you've got a room full of homogenous folks that all look the same and think the same and perhaps are, you know, a little bit self-congratulatory, perhaps you miss some insights like, I don't know, the digital revolution, right? Perhaps you get a little bit complacent. One of the things that I've been really gratified by in my work at the Community Foundation is a chance to bring in a perspective that's imbued with the set of experiences that I bring to the table that are different than some of my colleagues. And fortunately, we have created the kind of environment where that's appreciated. But it's not just to make me feel good. It's because what we do is better because it's informed by those insights. And so I think it's important for organizations to start seeing diversity as a mission critical, in the same way that you wouldn't say, oh, you know what, we're just going to skip the audit this year. You wouldn't say, you know what, we're just going to skip, you know, essential parts of the business because they contribute to us being a successful entity. Let's not say let's skip equity this year, right? Let's not worry about it. Let's just check the box. And the extent to which organizations start to see that, and they start to see that equity is a key driver for their own success, right? And ironically, then, for our community's success, then we end up all doing better.
Do you think most companies that engage in at least workshops and trainings are actually serious about this, or do you think most are doing the check-in-the-box stuff?
I think it's a mixed bag, honestly. I think a lot of it is, though, I think a lot of it's headline risk. I think a lot of it's, you know, that you've got some folks in organizations that really do believe in diversity, and again, for kind of the moral imperative. What I don't see enough of, frankly, is organizations, again, that are embracing diversity and equity as part of a strategy that drives their organizational success. And like I said, we could do this literally often. I could point out examples of organizations that have not embraced these kinds of principles, and as a result, particularly because of the lack of heterogeneity, continue to make bad decisions. They're uninformed. They're clumsy. And oh, by the way, they also end up leaving out whole segments of the community, which actually ends up undermining the entire business environment in a place like Rochester. And the thing that's fascinating, the Urban Institute actually did some research that municipalities and places that are embracing equitable practices, right, by far are outpacing those that do not in terms of their economic performance and their vibrancy. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that, right? Because when you've got a bigger pool of talent to draw from, and you really are allowing for merit to be expressed, right, talent to be expressed in a non-exclusionary environment, you get better performance, right? So for all kinds of reasons, the moral reasons, I mean, if you need headline risk, I guess do that. But also because we can be better, right? Our organizations can perform better. That ought to be a motivating factor, too.
And just to follow up that, the one of the points you're making there, Simeon, frankly, all of our guests have made, just on how we limit the possible achievement of any company when we have a very narrow view of what quote-unquote talent is or what firms or companies are looking for. Simeon, there was a family member of mine who said to me a little while back, he said, I'd never really understood that idea effectively until he heard an analogy of all things, United States soccer. Now, we're this big country, and we get our butts kicked in soccer around the world. Mm-hmm. And around the world, other nations look at the way we play soccer, and they say, yeah, well, turns out that you have a very narrow view of technical skill. All the kids who are, by the way, usually rich enough and advantaged enough to end up in training programs end up trained exactly the same way. Their creativity is restrained, and they're very technical, and they're not very creative, and they really get run up and down the field when they get on the field with countries, frankly, that don't have those restrictions and have a wide range of their thought on what could be creative and effective and quality. Of all things, it was a soccer analogy, and this family member said to me, I get it now. Like, in firms and companies, that makes sense to me, too, that if you have a very narrow view of what works or what we're looking for, what should be on a resume, then maybe we're excluding too many people. I mean, as strange as that analogy is, does that work, Simeon?
It absolutely does, right? In some sense, it's a math problem, right? And if you have a bigger pool that you're drawing from and allowing talent to really express itself, again, you end up with better performance, right? You end up with more creative solutions to problems. You end up seeing things outside of the box. For businesses, you end up being able to engage with different customer bases that have, you know, largely been neglected. And I'll tell you something else, too. I'll give you another quick example. Let's take Rochester City School District, whose budget challenges have largely been driven, at least significantly in part, by expanding need for special education, right? Part of what we know about RCSD is that there's some bias in terms of which kids end up in special education with assignments of IEPs or 504s and so on and so forth, right? Part of that is racial bias that's a function of a homogeneous environment where the vast majority of teachers live outside of the city of Rochester, aren't connected with communities of color. Literally, Evan, we have a situation where racial bias is driving the budget explosion that's happened for the RCSD over the last few years. Having folks that are more connected, having diverse folks that are part of the workforce, who can see different insights, who can say, you know what, that's not really a special education need. That's actually just a rambunctious little girl that needs these kinds of interventions, right? There are opportunities all across our, you know, community and across different sectors, in the public sector, in the private sector, in the nonprofit world, that, and again, functionally, it's a question of what we value. Right? What do we value, and are we willing to compensate for that value? Mm-hmm. And that takes us down a different road for sure, but it's a necessary one because what we're currently doing, guess what? That doesn't work.
Yeah, and let me ask our other guest about that. Adrian Hale, do you see companies expanding their view on what they value and why?
Well, I think there's a number of different efforts going on right now that are trying to make the case because we have some pretty serious global issues that are confronting us whether we like it or not. Obviously, poverty and inequality in and of itself is the greatest threat to the U.S.'s economic growth moving forward. And there's other countries whose economic development is starting to outpace our own. Climate change and the way that we do production is starting to become a serious issue, whether we even have a home to live on in and of itself. And so I think there's a number of different initiatives right now, whether it's Harvard Business School's Creating Shared Value initiative that tries to align the social needs with the needs of business and not say that, you know, philanthropy and charity and or funding nonprofit organizations is enough to say you're doing the right thing. But the way you do business in and of itself needs to be more favorable to human conditions and planetary conditions. And I'll just give you a quick example. It's not enough for McDonald's to build jungle gyms if their food is giving kids heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and those kinds of actual, you know, bodily, biological harm. Right? Like, we have to find a way for McDonald's to produce healthier meals the same way they want to produce quick meals. You understand? So it's those kinds of, I think, new areas of awareness that are challenging the business community right now to do better. You have the World Economic Forum, stakeholder capitalism. You have conscious capitalism, which obviously, you know, Andrew Brady well, he's a champion for. So there's a lot of different areas, even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the equality of opportunity effort. So right now, I think business is well aware that there are external factors beyond, you know, the profit motive that need to drive and inform the way business is done. And I think there's also a lot of conversation coming up out of the public sector when you look at, you know, proposals like Andrew Yang's Freedom Dividend or Bernie Sanders' crusade for socialism and economic transformation. As they try to say, how do we kind of, you know, fix and remediate some of the, you know, social conditions that are a result of an economy that isn't working for everyone? And I think there needs to be a marriage of the two, because in one area we cannot cede the institution of work. It is too critical, especially as it relates to some of these larger challenges now with COVID-19, at public health, climate change, national security, all these other factors. So we can't see work.
But in addition to that, we also need to improve the standard and quality of work and the distribution of opportunity within the workplace to ensure that it's more equitable. And I just want to say this to the listeners. You know, Simeon made some powerful, powerful points. And if there's anyone who has questions of like, how does equitable policies make, you know, organizations run better, or how does inclusive practices cause organizations to actually perform better, please reach out to the station. Evan can get information to those questions to us, and we can give you answers, because this really isn't, I don't like when we talk about this in the abstraction. I think we lose a lot of people. They don't understand how doing things differently can really improve the performance of a business and make a metropolitan economy, you know, much more productive. So please send those questions to Evan. He can get those to us, and we can talk explicitly to you about how doing things differently can really benefit your organization.
Mohammed, what do you think?
I just want to say, as a former soccer player, I appreciate the analogy you made with the tactical versus technical thing. It's really important. I concur with everything that I'm listening to with my colleagues here. First, as someone who actually, our firm actually does a lot of training around diversity, but what we've done is we train the trainers. So we have a certification program with two of them that we designate folks, because we have shied away from doing what we call the onesies, whereby a speaker comes in and or a trainer comes in and does an unconscious bias and walk away. The issue there, I wanted to take it back to your training question, is the lack of sustainability with these efforts. And oftentimes when you bring people in to do these trainings and you leave a vacuum, when people have been opened up to these the realities that exist within the organization, but there's no one there or group of people there to keep the pressure on and also sustain the efforts, these things are going to die. In essence, what we're talking about, all the things you've heard my colleagues share with you, is an issue of culture. What is the ethos of the organization and the leadership styles that are, you know, leading or guiding that culture? And what is the case to make for what is now a dying art of social responsibility in the communities in which businesses and organizations function? One of which is, you will hear two things here, tying this as mission critical is a business case for diversity versus the social justice imperative for diversity, equity, and inclusion. So what we often see is that these two things are pivoted against each other as though there's some mutually exclusive efforts that need to happen. And what we argue is that, no, they're not. And so herein lies the fact. When the rubber meets the road, you find often that folks will shy away from doing what is sustainable, what is going to be challenging and lead to a lot of discomfort, particularly because there's a lot of unlearning that has to happen when you do this work of diversity in organizations. Because of all the different things that my colleagues highlighted, from biases, from perceptions and conditioning that we have personally and also organizationally, to all the way to the lack of resources being allocated to these efforts, we find that it's very difficult for folks to come to the table intentionally and engage meaningfully with this work. So I concur with everything that is being said. There's a plethora of examples to use to demonstrate to people, actually, this works. This is not us trying to communicate some abstract concepts to people. These are specific examples across industry and sectors that have demonstrated that an intentional and an inclusive group of people far outperform and outweigh any group that is homogenous in nature. The additional piece here that I wanted to add a little bit here is that this issue of sustainability with lacking resources to allocate it for people in the organization is also something that is seen, that diversity is seen as this outside entity that needs to be on the sidelines. If we make it mission critical, then it makes it a lot easier for us to address those issues.
You're hearing Mohammed Ahmed from EDI, Engaging Diversity and Inclusion, an executive search and diversity consulting firm in Rochester. Simeon Bannister is here from the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Adrian Hale is here from the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. We've got some of your feedback as we talk about not just the comments from the Wells Fargo CEO, but what the wider sort of corporate world and frankly all of the hiring world ought to take from these comments. Those comments from the CEO came in a company-wide memo in which the CEO of Wells Fargo was answering questions about why they don't hire more black people. He said, well, there's just not a very diverse talent pool of black people to recruit from. He has since walked those remarks back, but they do reflect the view of a lot of the corporate world. So let's take that only break and your feedback on the other side. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about climate displacement, when climate change forces people to move, sometimes long distances, sometimes to different countries. Well, in the United States, climate displacement is on its way to being a very real thing. Just ask Californians. We talked to former Rochesterians living in California yesterday. One of the co-sponsors of the Climate Displaced Persons Act in Congress is Joe Morelli. He joins us, among others, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joel writes to us to say the natural world thrives on diversity. It's past time that businesses, schools, and organizations think in a similar fashion. That's from Joel, and a sort of, I think, an unimpeachably wise point about the natural world. Andrew says, Evan, if a photographer is trying to get a picture of a beautiful bald eagle and goes out to get a shot, but no eagles leave the nest that day, is the photographer to blame for coming home without a picture of a bald eagle? Andrew is comparing that to companies that say they want to hire people of color but can't find them. Andrew's saying you can't blame the companies if there aren't candidates. Well, Andrew, let's again turn back to our panel on this, because this is exactly what we heard four years ago when we did a series that we called Degrees of Diversity, in which we looked at the lack of hiring of teachers of color in public school settings K through 12 in Western New York. And the numbers shocked even listeners who thought there would be a disparity. The disparities were huge, and superintendents were telling us all the time, same thing Andrew is saying here in this email, hey, you know, we looked, nobody applied, you know, so you really can't blame us. Almost 5 years later, I'm not sure how much has changed in the school district level, but let's ask all three of our guests. I'll just go down the list. Adrian Hale, I think you make an important point. You want to get away from just conceptual, and you want to get into the actual hard work of practice, of getting this stuff done.
Okay.
So for a company or a school district that says, we put an opening, we posted an opening, we had 100 resumes, and none or very few were people of color, so you can't blame us. How can we hire someone who doesn't apply? Take me through that. Let's talk about what to do here. Adrian?
So again, I want to go back to the comments that Simeon made in the onset when he referred to the congressperson from New York City who said maybe Wells Fargo doesn't have the aptitude to hire and recruit, you know, black executives. There is a science and an art to recruiting in a diverse fashion. And one of our colleagues on today's panel is literally that's the work that he does. But just from my vantage point, I want to put it out there like this. You have to look at the job description and you have to see what are the prerequisites and requirements that are within that job description, which oftentimes are exclusive by design. In addition to that, you have to make sure that you are using channels that reach diverse audiences, because oftentimes you can post a job in a place that has the same kinds of traffic, or to Simeon's point earlier, it can literally be only told through these social networks and connections and never reach the broader public to begin with. So there's a whole bunch of different things that organizations can do to really enhance their capabilities of ensuring that they recruit diverse audiences. But literally, we have a panelist on here who does this, and I would imagine that he would be able to give you more insight.
All right, Mohammed, let's answer Andrew's email there. Go ahead.
Thank you, Adrian. I agree with everything Adrian just mentioned, and including that there is research around this issue. This idea that these are unicorns in our society is really problematic, and is something that has actually undergird a lot of the recruitment efforts we see across the country. It takes a couple of questions just from our surveys with our clients to really get to the bottom of this. A couple of them, what we do is they always ask us, what can we do? What do we do? Well, one of the questions we ask is, where did you look? How did you look? Who did you engage while you were looking? A study from Harvard tells us that if you have one diverse candidate in a pool of 10, you are less than likely to hire a diverse candidate. But if you increase that number to 3 to 4, you are more than likely to hire a diverse candidate. So herein lies the fact that you really have to be intentional in where you're looking. What we also see is that oftentimes the job descriptions are actually appalling to people. That some of the descriptors mm-hmm. in there are problematic to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They dismiss, they undermine, and this notion, the perception that the talent is not going to come from the places that we look. There's also an often misalignment with diversity with opportunity. We just want to use affirmative action. This is an issue of no. When you engage with folks like who are focused in this area, we have seen so many different areas where we were able to bring in a slate of candidates that actually shocks the people that are trying to hire. But there is something that leads to this in the hiring practice that we call affinity bias. People are often trying to hire those who look, act, talk, walk, and behave like them. So if you have a homogenous environment, the affinity bias is throughout the interview process, they are looking for someone who looks like them, who talks like them, who acts like them. And often the rest of the candidates are left out. So what you see in what Simeon was mentioning, there's specific AI out there now blocking names from resumes all the way to doing completely blind interview processes until the final stages of the candidacy of applicants. And then also one of the things that I would like to add is that there are so many different ways to do this. There are partnerships that you could strike intentionally to make sure that you're building those relationships within the organization and outside to bring in people. There's also something that I find that is very important that I want to say before I keep my mouth shut on this, is that folks usually when they apply to jobs, they do their own research. And they will peruse your site, they will go on and do their own homework. If you look homogenous and you bring in somebody who is not qualified to take on that pressure of being the first in that space, to shoulder that pressure, then you're going to do yourself a disservice because they will leave short after. They cannot retain folks who are not prepared. So one of the things we do is whomever, if it's the first or first few that you're bringing in into your organization, we work to try to prepare them for what they are going into so that you don't have this, you know, revolving door of nothingness, as we call it.
Mohammed, what's the website for people who want to learn more about what you do at EDI?
EDIESC.com.
EDIESC.com. And Simeon Bannister, about the last 80 seconds are yours on this issue. What would you leave us with as we think about, you know, everything from school districts to companies? I mean, you know, our children's teachers are going to largely be lacking in diversity for most of their teaching career unless these kind of things changes, unless districts actually take some of the approach that Mohammed's just talking about, Simeon.
Yeah, so I would just extend the listener's metaphor, right? While you were busy looking for the eagle, you missed the peregrine falcon, the rooster, the swan, all along the way. And those could have been equally striking pictures. But because of the limitations and how we see value, right, that we missed the opportunity to engage in the broad diversity, again, in this metaphor, that would make for striking photos. What I see, just as an example of that, in Rochester City School District, we just saw 116 paraprofessionals get furloughed or laid off, right? Mm. And those paraprofessionals, they bring value in their relationships and connections to young people. Can we rethink credentialing? Can we rethink what it means to be a good teacher? Can we also think about the social and emotional learning components, the relational quality, particularly in a district like Rochester? I would argue that we have to rethink it because it's not like we were just knocking it out of the park given the current credentials and the current system that's in place. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it just, you know, at this point, we have to rethink value. The other thing I'd say is, Evan, I'm a grant maker, right, by trade. That's what I do. If I get an organization that comes in and they haven't done an audit, I say to myself, I have misgivings about whether this organization is sufficiently competent to get work done. I am starting to feel the same way when I see a lack of diversity. Are you really creative? Are you really bringing us the best solutions? Can you actually connect with the community? Those are the kinds of questions that we have to start asking about how we see value so that we fundamentally change how the system operates, the background noise, the zeitgeist that we all take for granted.
I'm grateful for the time. Simeon Bannister, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Adrian Hale, thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
Muhammad Ahmed, nice having you. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much.
Important conversation. More connections coming up next.